Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's part two of our discussion of The Hungry Brain. It's a great new book by our guest, Dr. Stéphane Guillenet. It just came out, and I recommend it very highly for health professionals and some of you smart, intelligent medicine listeners, because it's going to give you some insights into what, is wired, hardwired into our brains, into our physiology. And an understanding of that can help us overcome the susceptibility to overweight. That's the underlying message of the book. So, Dr. Guillenet, you actually tackled the question in a recent blog. I found it quite fascinating. People are writing books, and we've had some guests who criticize the U.S. dietary guidelines as causing the current epidemic of obesity. I think you take a little bit more, should we say, a little more discerning view of what's going on.
Yeah, that's right. I think that just to give the audience a little bit of perspective on the American diet, in 2010, the USDA Dietary Guidelines for Americans report was released, or at least a report was released. And in that report, they had some information on what Americans eat, so where our primary sources of calories are coming from. And the number one source of calories in the U.S. diet is something called grain-based desserts, which includes cake and brownies and donuts and cookies. That is literally the number one source of calories in the American diet. And also in the top six, we have soda, we have pizza, we have alcoholic beverages, bread, and chicken dishes, much of which is fried chicken nuggets. So if you look at the dietary guidelines, what is being recommended by the U.S. government, it's largely a whole food-based diet that's low in processed food, low in added sugars and fats. You cannot tell me with a straight face that that is not a better diet than what we are eating today and what we have been eating for the last 30 years in this country. I mean, there's no version of a whole food diet that is worse than what we're currently eating.
Right.
I mean, I think to blame the obesity and diabetes epidemics on the USDA dietary guidelines is just an extraordinary stretch. I mean, especially, you know, one of the things that people will focus on is sugar. They'll say, well, those guidelines cause us to eat more sugar. But if you look at the guidelines, they always, throughout the entire last almost 40 years now, they've recommended that we eat less sugar and eat less foods that contain sugar. So I just really don't see much of a basis at all for claiming that those guidelines caused obesity or diabetes. It doesn't make any sense.
But what about the macronutrient distribution? I think, it's the law of unintended consequences. When the dietary guidelines tell us to have, 5 to 7 servings of whole grains, and that translates to, whole grain bagels and, whole grain maybe with a little whole grain added, cornflakes. Could that in some way have led people to accept a whole category of macronutrients, namely carbohydrates, while stigmatizing protein and fat that may have been more helpful to provide satiety that would have helped people lose weight?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. It's really hard to say, though, because, I mean, what you see is that we do eat more whole grains today than we did 30 years ago, but it's not really a large change. I mean, mostly what increased as the obesity rate increased was sugar from things like soda, which were clearly recommended against, and refined carbohydrate from things like grain-based desserts and pizza. Like, from my perspective, there's not really any way to twist the U.S. dietary guideline recommendations so that they support the consumption of donuts and pizza and brownies. I mean, there's not any rational interpretation, even the most twisted, you know, way of looking at it would not support the diet that we eat. So I think that, I don't know, I mean, it's possible that there was some influence in some way indirectly, maybe, I'm not sure. It's just difficult to test and difficult to prove that idea. But I think one thing that is clear is that there's, that there was a very pronounced shift over that same period of time in how we interact with food in this country. So it used to be that most food in this country was prepared in the home, in the kitchen, from single ingredients. And over the course of the last half century, that has changed dramatically. So now, very little of the food that Americans eat now is cooked in the home from single ingredients.
Yep.
Primarily, we spend a lot of our money in restaurants, and that we purchase in grocery stores, by and large, is pre-processed in some way. Mm-hmm. And we spend way more money on fast food than we ever did. There's been a ninefold increase since the 1960s. And so I think that there's been a very profound shift in American food culture that I think has changed the way that we interact with food, and it's changed the type of food that we're eating. But how much of that can be attributed to the guidelines, mm-hmm. I just don't really see a very strong basis for attributing a lot of that change to the guidelines.
Mm-hmm. So focusing on foods, you know, you talk about the food qualities that make us eat more or make us feel full. I guess that would be palatability versus satiety. You know, clearly our primitive brains guide us towards palatability. You know, we're, you know, seeking it out wherever we can find it, looking for calories in all the wrong places. But satiety is really what we're looking for, especially if we want to contain our unruly appetites. So describe those food qualities and how does that practically translate if we're trying to get on a healthy food plan?
Yeah, and I think this relates to a very important brain function. So basically, and this is one of the things I talk about in my book, as you know, the feeling of satiety, I think this is what's really important to understand about satiety that most people don't understand, that feeling of satiety or fullness that you get at the end of the meal generally is not occurring because your stomach is physically full. It feels like your stomach is full. It feels like you can't fit any more food, but generally your stomach still has a lot more room available. What that sensation is that is a part of your brain called the brainstem saying you've had enough. And that's when that sensation of satiety arises. And part of that does have to do with how much food is in your stomach. So there are sensors that detect, there are stretch sensors in your stomach that detect the volume of what's in there. But a lot of other information also converges on the brainstem to determine what the strength of that signal. And so there are sensors in your small intestine that are detecting protein and fat and carbohydrate. And then there are sensors in your mouth, of course, that are detecting the taste and the palatability. All that information converges in your brainstem into that satiety signal. And so it turns out that some foods confer a lot more satiety per calorie than others. So the way that they plug into that system, they kind of disproportionately create that feeling of fullness. And those are really some of the key properties that we can exploit to create a slimming dietary pattern. And so if you think about, well, okay, so I'll describe what those properties are. So first of all, the less calorie dense food is, that is, the fewer calories per unit volume or per unit weight, the more satiety it's going to create per unit calorie, because the same number of calories are filling up your stomach more.
Mm-hmm.
The higher protein something is, the more satiety it's going to create per calorie.
Mm-hmm.
The higher fiber it is, the more satiety it's going to create. And the lower the palatability. So if something tastes really, really good, it's not going to fill you up as effectively as something that's just okay. Unfortunately, unfortunate truth.
So some people suggest, and this is the the proponents of a ketogenic diet that is high in fat, is that fat per se is the prime satiety agent, and that carbohydrates, by triggering insulin, trigger a cycle of craving, and so you want to restrict your carbs, and you want to eat a lot of fats. Do you have an issue with that assertion?
I don't think that's correct, and I think there's actually a lot of evidence suggesting it's not correct. There are quite a number of studies that look at the relative satiety value of fats versus carbohydrates. And what those studies have shown is that if calorie density and palatability are held constant, fat and carbohydrate have virtually identical satiating value per calorie. So they're basically the same. However, I think that doesn't necessarily mean that a ketogenic diet or a low-carbohydrate diet is not effective for controlling appetite. I think it can be effective, but I don't think that's because fat is more satiating. I think ketogenic diet, we don't quite understand exactly why that suppresses appetite, but I will say that you see a very similar phenomenon on the other extreme, which is a very low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet.
You like a sort of Dean Ornish-type diet, that kind of thing, or macro diet, something along those lines.
Or John McDougall. You see a similar suppression of appetite and fat loss. And so I don't think it's really something that's unique to fat versus carbohydrate per se. I think that's a phenomenon that the brain and body initiate when you get to macronutrient extremes. And I think it's kind of interesting because, and this is just me speculating here. I don't know for certain that this is correct, but, what you see in states of deficiency, of nutritional deficiencies, and this is true for minerals and vitamins as well, you see a marked reduction of appetite, and you see weight loss. And then when those micronutrients are replaced, you see weight gain, you see the weight regain and the appetite regain. So I wonder whether, this is my speculation, I'm speculating that the body essentially views a very, very low carbohydrate diet or a very, very low fat diet as a deficiency state, and it kind of kicks in that same response that constrains appetite and reduces body fat level.
Okay. That's, I think, an interesting way of explaining the paradox of why people seem to do well on diametrically opposed diets, and the argument will persist from vegan low-fat acolytes versus the folks who say eat a lot of fat and animal protein and cut the carbs. All right, we're going to pause for just a moment for a brief announcement. And when we return, I'm going to ask our guest, Dr. Stefan Gaine, to focus more on some practical applications of this theory about how the brain works and what can help us stem the tide of our current epidemic of obesity. This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. The Zona Plus is a high-tech smart device that guides you through a patented therapy that's personalized to your unique physiology. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 888-408-6141. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, you can get $50 off and free shipping. Just use the coupon code Hoffman at checkout at tryzona.com. Dr. Gaine, when we're trying to design an ideal program for outsmarting the hungry brain, There's actually, that's in the title, Outsmarting the Instincts That Make Us Overeat. What are some of the elements of that? There's some surprising elements that don't even have so much to do with what you do when you come to the table.
Yeah, that's right. I think the basic principle here, so we have this impulsive brain, this instinctive brain that's composed of many different circuits that are kind of pushing us to overdo it, pushing us to overeat. And then we have this rational brain that's trying to control our behavior in a way that we want it to go. So really what you want to do, so these impulsive, non-conscious brain circuits that are driving us to overeat, they are responsive to the cues they receive. So they're very reactive to the cues in your environment that surround you, as well as cues that they're receiving from inside your body, like your energy state and your hormonal state and things like that. So basically what we want to do, the goal here, is to give those non-conscious systems the right cues so that you are aligning your impulses with your conscious desires to eat the right amount of food and eat healthy food and be lean. And so you were particularly, you mentioned some of the things that don't necessarily have to do when we're at the table. So I'll focus on those things.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the most important things is controlling your food environment. So just not exposing yourself to cues for tempting foods that you don't want to eat, or just in general.
Mm-hmm.
Because the circuits that motivate us to want to eat are very reactive to the sight and the smells of food. And so if those things are around, and especially if they're easy to consume, then we're much more likely to do so. So taking things out of sight, taking them, if you can, even out of the house, calorie-dense, unhealthy foods, and then having the foods that are in your house have a small effort barrier to consumption.
Hmm.
So basically, if you want to go
just like the hunter-gatherers, that you go back to that equation that there is, you kind of have to work to gather those roots and berries or track down that antelope.
That's exactly right, exactly. And so even a small effort barrier can decrease the perceived value of that food to your brain.
Hmm.
And so basically what that means is that you have to be more motivated or more hungry for your brain to actually want to initiate that behavior. And so if you go for the peanuts and you have to open shells to get to the nuts,
that's a good example,
instead of just grabbing a handful of peanuts, then that small effort barrier will help you control your intake. And
I do that with pistachios. I do that with pistachios. I never get the shelled pistachios. I always have to laboriously open them up. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great example because those are a lot of work. or peeling an orange or something like that, as opposed to having things on the counter that you can just grab. And also having foods that aren't excessively tempting. I mean, if you have, you know, brownies sitting on the counter, or if you have potato chips or something that you really, really like just sitting there, that is a very powerful cue for the parts of your brain that determine food motivation. So, you know, you want the things that are in your food environment on a regular basis to be simple, and you want there to be, you know, simple satisfying foods like nuts in shells and fruit that maybe you have to peel, like an orange, and you want it to be, you want there to be a little effort barrier as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the ideal scenario for your food environment. And then there are some other things you can do that don't have to do with food at all, like managing your sleep and stress.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So insufficient or poor quality sleep is one of the things that causes us to increase our food intake. So studies by a number of different groups, but in particular Dr. Saint-Onge, have shown that if you restrict sleep to like 4 hours a night, you're going to eat a couple hundred extra calories the next day.
I noticed that on election eve, you know, staying up late to watch the election returns. I was so hungry the next day. I don't know. Maybe I was just, I was just consoling myself. But
it could have been. It could have been a combination of lack of sleep and stress.
Yeah. Right. Right.
But anyway, yeah. So getting sufficient and high quality sleep, basically, if you don't do that, it tells some of the parts of your brain that regulate food intake and body fatness. It kind of kicks in a little mini version of that starvation response that happens when a person loses weight. So your brain is basically seems to be thinking that it's starving when it's really not. Yeah. And that'll drive you to eat more food.
And there's the cortisol connection of stress, and cortisol is certainly an appetite stimulating hormone. We know that people who get prednisone for medical reasons tend to become obese and diabetic.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It has some pretty negative body weight and metabolic effects. And the weight gain that occurs is particularly in the abdominal region, which is the worst place to gain fat. And you actually see that in people with high levels of psychological stress. You see that they tend to have higher levels of abdominal fat, and they have worse markers of physiological health, so higher risk of diabetes. And many researchers believe that that's due to higher levels of cortisol. And you actually see that people who secrete high levels of cortisol when they're stressed, they tend to overeat and they tend that in their abdominal region. So I think managing stress is another important element of that. And one piece of that I think is really important that a lot of people don't know about is that there's a big difference between stress that feels like it's under our control, controllable stress, and stress that feels like it's not in our control, uncontrollable stress. So, and it's very much a matter of perspective often whether something feels controllable or not controllable, but uncontrollable stress, like let's say you have a family member who's ill and you're a caretaker and it's just, there's not really much you can do about the illness and it's burdensome, for everybody. That has a much more powerful effect on cortisol and on body weight and on health than controllable stress. Like, for example, having a challenge at your job that you feel like you are qualified for and you feel like you can overcome. It's tough. But you know you can do it, and you know you'll come out on top. That does not have the same sort of harmful effects on eating behavior and body composition.
Well, yeah. In fact, when they study humans, when they study lab animals, of course, they can give them random electrical shocks to induce stress. That's not considered humane. You never get it past an institutional review board here in the States. But they use the relatives of Alzheimer's patients to study the effects of stress, because that's a model. That's one of as you stated, that's an example of pathological stress where you feel a loss of control. You refer to the buffet effect as understanding that can help you with a strategy for eating.
Yeah, I think this is a pretty actionable variable, actually, because this refers to the tendency to overeat when we have a lot of food options on the table at once. And so, and most people will recognize that they overeat at buffets. And the reason for that is that the more variety there is in a meal, the more total calories we tend to eat. So basically we become sated on specific types of flavor profiles, but we don't really become sated on others. So the satiation we feel is kind of, the satiety that we feel is kind of specific to the food that we ate. It's called sensory-specific satiety. And so the upshot, as I said, is that we tend to eat a lot more calories when we have a lot of options. And so I think this suggests a very simple, practical way to control our calorie intake, and that is limit the number of things that you eat at a meal. You know, eat just two or three things that are simple mm-hmm. and satisfying and leave it at that.
Indeed, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, suggestions like that and many other practical suggestions come out of a very detailed understanding of neuroanatomy and neurophysiology in this book, The Hungry Brain, Outsmarting the Instincts That Make Us Overeat by Stéphane Guyenet. And it's spelled Guyenet. And why you may want to know how to spell that name is because you've got a website, right?
Correct.
Tell us about what's
and
there.
And you can, you can get there either using my name, StephanGuyenet.com, or you can get there through wholehealthsource.org if that's easier. But there you'll find my blog, you'll find a page for The Hungry Brain, and you will find my fat loss program, which is the ideal weight program, which my friend and business partner Dan Party and I are working on rolling out a new version of right now.
Great. So that will be a resource to people who are desirous of weight loss with a practical program that's based on real science.
Yeah, and it dovetails with the book as well. The new version will.
Great. Well, hey, it's really a pleasure talking to you, and you know, I admire your work. I always look to you for a sensible analysis of some of the hot button issues in nutrition. It's always science-based and thoughtful, and so I recommend the book, and I recommend that people check out your website to get the 411 on some important nutrition issues. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much. My pleasure.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.